Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Geek Tyrant Weekly Podcast. This is episode number 86. My name is Ben P., and joining me today are a couple of good friends of mine. We got Mazer here. Mazer, what's happening?
Hey, guys. What's up?
I got a quick question for you, as we've taken to doing in the recent weeks, just asking random questions. This week's question, what is your favorite Nicolas Cage movie?
Ooh.
I'm going to have to go with Raising Arizona.
Nice choice.
Yeah. There's some other choices where like he's tolerable and stuff like that, but yeah. I don't want to steal anyone's choices.
Good stuff. All right. We've also got P. Vader joining us. P. Vader, how's it going?
Doing good.
And same question, sir.
Well, I guess because I'm not going to be stealing anyone's choices, I can maybe talk about it a little bit. Kick-Ass is really good.
Yeah, that was one I was
you
pretty happy with.
You were wavering on that one?
Yeah.
I almost don't even really consider that a Nicolas Cage
movie. Yeah.
For some reason, it just doesn't really... I don't know.
That wasn't my choice. I'm going to go with Gone in 60 Seconds.
That's a good one.
I just remember back in the day when I was, eighth grade or something?
I think so, yeah.
I was like, I can't wait for this movie. And it was not as good as I was expecting, but as I've kind of grown older, and Nicolas Cage is like a fine wine. You learn to appreciate
it
with age, you know.
Yeah,
I still do the rolling the fingers around your head,
yeah,
like kind of thing, and then the let's roll.
Yeah,
thing.
Sometimes yourself.
Every now and again, I feel the need to do that.
Every time you hear Lowrider, right?
Yeah,
exactly. Which is often in L.A.
Good stuff.
In case you were wondering what it's like, it's just like the movies. It's not.
There's constant shootouts and all kinds of things. So, let's see. This week on the show, we're just going to talk a little bit about some fictional bands in movies. We're not going to review a movie. Nothing really that interesting came out this week. So, we're just going to talk about our kind of favorite or just some random fictional bands on film. And then we'll go into some geek news, talking a little bit about the Tony Scott's new movie Nemesis, based on Mark Miller's comic. Darren Aronofsky possibly in the running for director on Wolverine 2 and a buddy cop movie featuring Ryan Reynolds and Bradley Cooper. So, but before we do that, let's move into box office. Well, okay, let's do a little bit of the box office numbers for this weekend. Let's not jump the gun on this thing. So this weekend at the box office, the top films were number one, Takers with $20.5 million.
I've got to say, it's got the worst movie poster I have ever seen. If you guys ever seen it, it looks like every single person was photoshopped into it.
I know. That's a good point.
So bad.
Badly photoshopped. It's like no one agreed to be in this poster.
I thought that Hayden Christensen was going to be terrible in this, and I haven't seen the movie, but I remember reading somebody's response on Twitter or something, like, Hayden Christensen, a pleasant surprise in the movie. I'm like, really? That is shocking to me. But in any case, Takers, I don't know, maybe we'll talk about that if we ever get around to seeing it on DVD. Doubt it! number two at the box office, The Last Exorcism. This movie made $20.3 million. I don't think I've ever seen a trailer for this.
It's kind of documentary style of this guy who does exorcisms, and this is The Last Exorcism, right?
Eli Roth is involved in some capacity, right? Like producing or something like that?
Memory's a bit fuzzy on it, but... It seems like it was pretty cool. I mean, I haven't seen it. For me, I try to consume my horror at home,
yeah,
usually, but...
I thought you were going to say The Last Airbender. I was like, wow, that had a resurgence there.
Number two.
Maybe it will make its budget. I don't know.
They re-released it without dialogue. It's just they amped up the score, and they redid the effects.
It's a totally different movie. So number three at the box office, The Expendables, $9.5 million hanging in there. Number four, Eat, Pray, Love, still seems to be that battle between those two movies, with $6.8 million. And then rounding out the top five of the box office this weekend is The Other Guys, which is surprisingly sticking around with $6.2 million. Good stuff. I'm glad people are still going to see that. That's one of my favorite movies of the summer so far.
Really?
We talked about that, you know, a couple weeks ago or whatever. I really enjoyed that movie.
Oh, but I saw the special edition Avatar.
Did you?
I did.
Did you go see it in the theaters?
Yeah, I went actually to the Arclight Cinerama Dome.
Okay.
To see it in IMAX.
How was that?
It was pretty good.
Did you notice the extra 9 minutes of footage?
I did notice a few extra things, but it didn't feel like a lot longer. I just know, you know, in editing, 9 minutes is a lot of time.
Yeah.
To add back in.
Yeah.
So I mean, I think there were a few. The most notable thing was like there was a, gosh, Jake's Sully's like rival there in the tribe, his death. Like, you just see him, like, just fall down, and that's it. But he survives that, and you actually see his death scene.
Like a prolonged
yeah. thing.
Okay.
So, that's a little bit, but, I mean, there was a pretty cool hunting sequence, which was pretty cool. It is interesting. All the new stuff doesn't feel incongruent with the rest of it. It feels, the effects have not been, like, they're not cheaper.
Yeah.
So they put, I don't know how much money they put in.
Right.
They probably put in quite a bit of money.
Yeah. Good stuff. All right. Well, yeah, I'm interested to see the people's response to the DVD winner, like the special edition Blu-ray or whatever that's coming out with like an extra 7 minutes. So it's what, 16 on top of that or something?
Yeah. So he's, yeah.
Or 16 total extra
minutes.
It's
been announced that he's going to do the original theatrical, the special edition, and the super extended edition. Yeah. So,
oh, James Cameron and your money making ways. All right, so let's jump into this week in box office history. We had kind of an interesting discussion right before we recorded about what year we were going to do, and then somebody jokingly suggested 2009. Obviously,
that was me
last year.
That was me, and then I was like, wait, I have such a terrible memory for time. I can't even describe how bad my relation to time is, but
I'm right there with you, so I'm glad that I don't have to do this. I'm the key master in this situation. I have the answers in front of me. So we're going to go jump in our time machine all the way back to August 28th through the 30th of 2009. So
please play along at home so I don't feel it.
Yeah, exactly. No, you guys, if you think you know it, please guess along. Okay, so you guys, what do you think was one of the top 10 movies at the box office this same weekend last year?
Well, Vader said, you know, he knew a movie that was going to come out, like, I guess a week after.
Yeah.
Because it was like...
9 came out on 9-9-09, but we're just conveniently not doing that week, so...
Okay.
But if I had to guess, I'm going to go with what I think was a pretty big movie for 2009, and that's going to be The Hangover. Is that in the top 10?
The Hangover is not in the top
10.
The Hangover was number 16 in its 13th week at the box office.
I knew that was a risk because I knew it had been out a while.
See, but... I'm thinking of a July film too, and I can't think of any other films in my memory.
Yeah.
I'm kind of fogged up at the moment.
August films, they're hard to guess.
What do you think, Mazer?
I can't think of any. I can't think of anything, but I'm going to say Harry Potter.
That's gotta be.
Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince was number 11.
Oh!
So close. That was in its seventh week at the box office, so you were right on with the...
I'm gonna venture another guess, because we have less people.
Okay, alright, go for it. Yeah, let's do it.
To make myself look even worse. I'm gonna go with another movie that I really enjoyed last year, and that's Public Enemies.
Public Enemies is not in the top 10.
That came out in, like, March.
It was number 30 at the box office that week. No, I'm sorry. Number 33 at the box office, making $164,000 in its ninth week, which is actually kind of terrible.
Yeah, because I knew it hadn't been out as long, and I was like, maybe I still have a chance with that.
No, and you guys, I mean, there's a couple movies in here that you might kick yourselves a little bit, but for the most part, you shouldn't feel too bad about yourself. So here we go. Let's run through the top 10 of the weekend of August 28th through the 30th, 2009. Number one, The Final Destination, $27 million. Number two, Inglourious Bastards.
I think I don't remember that at that, because people had been talking about it at Sundance.
Oh, yeah.
And it had already been released.
And canned all that stuff,
and
yeah.
So, yeah.
That one made $19 million. Number three, Halloween 2, which, I don't know, I would have pegged as an October release just for the common sense of it. And that made $16.3 million. Number four, District 9, in its third week, $10 million.
I think of that in 2008, I don't know why. I think of that coming out at the same time as, like, Iron Man, but I don't know.
Number 5, G.I. Joe, The Rise of Cobra, 7.7 million.
I've tried to forget the existence of that film.
Number 6, Julie and Julia, $7 million. Number 7, The Time Traveler's Wife, $6.4 million. Number 8, Shorts, $4.5 million. That's the Robert Rodriguez one. Number 9, Taking Woodstock, $3.4 million. And number 10, G-Force.
You want to know?
See, you know, now I don't feel so bad.
Yeah, you shouldn't, because
with
none
the exception
of
District 9, which I... Which, you know, thinking of the Oscar race, you should have totally just put that together, but...
Well, I've actually not seen any of those movies, which is why I didn't guess any
of them. You didn't see Inglourious Basterds?
No, I've yet to see it.
Or District 9?
No.
Dude, you gotta see those.
I'll let you borrow.
That was a bad movie year for me. I was poor.
We gotta make that. We gotta change that. So, anyway, there you have it, folks. This week in box office history from 2009. So, moving on into what is normally our review section, like I said at the very beginning, we're going to talk a little bit about some fictional bans on film. We made kind of an offhanded remark a few weeks ago about this. We were talking about soundtracks, favorite soundtracks and scores and things like that. And Mazur brought up the Josie and the Pussycats soundtrack as kind of a guilty pleasure. So, yeah, that just kind of inspired us to be like, hey, maybe we should do a podcast one of these weeks when nothing good comes out, just talking about fictional bands and things like that. So, I don't really know. How do you guys want to do this? You just kind of want to kind of list these things off? Because I kind of compiled a big list here.
Yeah, I built a list and I kind of had it in an ascending order.
Okay, well, let's go through your list first.
All right, so I'm going in order of music that I enjoyed or bands that I would... hope were real so that I could actually see them in concert.
Okay.
So this is on the list, and it's not so much, but more because of the fact that every time I heard this song, I couldn't get it out of my head for several hours after.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the Soggy Bottom Boys.
Oh, yeah.
From Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yes. Man of Constant Sorrow.
Exactly. And I think, did that get nominated?
I think it did for best song or something.
Did it
best
win?
I don't remember. That was back in 2000. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see. But yeah, it was such a great song. And I would say a tribute to Clooney to actually make himself look like he's actually singing it.
Yeah.
When you know it's not him.
Right.
Especially when he said he tried to do it and he burned those tapes because it was that bad. Yeah.
That's pretty great.
My next on is the Wild Stallions, which is the band of Bill and Ted.
Nice.
It's been so long since I've seen those movies. I think I was like 12 or something.
Yeah.
So long where I don't remember anything from them, which I feel like those movies are big kind of cult classics among people our age group. So I think
I don't remember the music being particularly great. I just remembered the idea that a band could make world peace was the coolest thing, plus the time machine and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But then they had like people from history in their band, and it made no sense, but it was pretty cool.
I do know that kind of world-renowned guitarist Steve Vai contributed some of the songs. Like one of the songs that they play is called "The Reaper," I think.
Okay.
And he played that song, which is pretty cool. But
yeah,
moving on.
So this is actually a very weird name, and I like the music so much that I bought it probably, you know, once I got home from watching the movie. And the movie I will never buy. I might recommend it. And that the band is Munchausen by Proxy, and the movie is Yes Man. So it's got Zoe Deschanel in it, and she's great. But it's just like these really, really weird songs. And they're extremely energetic, and they're pretty fun to listen to.
What parts... I don't remember. Oh, that was her band, the kind of like really obscure one that they went to the clubs and stuff to see her play, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. It's all slowly coming back to me. I saw the movie once, but
At that point, it seemed like she had to sing in every single movie she was in.
Right.
So, okay. Next is The Wonders or The Oneaters.
Yes.
From That Thing You Do.
Yes.
I don't know how many of you guys. My family bought like 2 copies of the soundtrack so we could listen at home and in the car.
Nice.
So,
I really enjoy that movie. That was from I was looking that up, compiling the list, and that was from 1996. That was a long time ago. And Tom Hanks wrote and directed that movie, as well as starred as like the band's manager. I think
I gotta say the music is like spot on. It feels like right out of that time period.
Yeah, everything like the set design and everything in that movie is really great.
Yeah, and I actually like that song so much, that Thing You Do, that it was actually played at the reception for my wedding
there
as
you
a
go.
Song. So
nice. I've got that in my iTunes as the under the kind of one hit wonder section.
Yeah, and then Stillwater from Almost Famous. For me, I liked it because my dad had all these bands that sounded like Stillwater, but I'd already heard them.
Yeah,
and Stillwater sounded like a band from that era that I'd never heard of.
Yeah.
So it was like discovery.
Yeah,
and that's what was cool about the movie. Is that I felt more connected because I felt like I was discovering this band.
Yeah, and you're already familiar with the culture, and I think that's a big point. Because I had almost the exact same experience where my dad listened to all that kind of music, you know, the Allman Brothers and Zeppelin and all that kind of stuff. And these guys are very much kind of ciphers for those types of bands.
Yeah.
You've seen this, right?
Yeah.
Almost Famous,
yeah.
What did you think of that movie? When was the...
It's been a long time since I've seen it. Like, I was like maybe 13 or something. And I think I saw it on TV. So I don't remember a whole lot about it, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Yeah. Alright.
And then, Abe Froman would be mad at me if I didn't include this on this. And it's also at the top of my list. And it is... Spinal Tap from This Is Spinal Tap.
Of course.
There's so many things quotable about this film, and no joke, I think with Abe, we've probably watched it at least 30 times, and he's probably watched it well into the hundreds. I'm not joking you. There's so many little details, and you find, like, not just one thing, but several things every single time you watch it.
Yeah.
And a different way to look at it. And I think it's really funny, but Abe was in a punk rock band.
Yeah.
He was in that band for like 4 years and toured across the country and Europe and released an album. And he knows all of those experiences, and he says like they're all really authentic, like everything that happens in that. And I think you can't write that material without having been in a band.
Yeah, totally.
And it's kind of interesting. It's like they have like their where they show them at different eras and. Like, this is the most ridiculous band ever. Although now I look back and I know people who jump from musical genre to musical genre, and I'm like, that really does happen, doesn't it?
Yeah. And I love the concept in that movie of their drummers dying mysteriously, like some by spontaneous combustion and others just by like freak gardening accidents and like other things. If you guys haven't seen Spinal Tap, please, for the love of God, go see it. It's funny.
One of them died choking on vomit, but not
his own.
Not his own.
Oh, great. Okay, cool. Well, yeah, that's Mazur's list. Like I said, we just kind of compiled like a big list of stuff. So I'll go through and read the ones that did not make your list. Starting with one of the more obscure ones, apparently, a band called Steel Dragon from the movie Rockstar. This movie came out in 2001. It starred Mark Wahlberg as a kind of a lead singer of a cover band for this band, Steel Dragon, who was plucked from obscurity when their actual lead singer, you know, whatever, left the band or something, so they replaced him with Mark Wahlberg's character. This movie, I really enjoyed it because I like that kind of 80s hair metal music, and that's kind of what this genre is parroting, like, probably the era right after Spinal Tap, I think, or, like, right past that time, like, right around there. But the movie, I think, does really, really well in the first half of it, and then just completely falls apart in the second when it turns into, like, this drug-fueled acid trip. Like, nobody knows what's going on. They're spending, you know, whatever, a good portion of the second half of the film in, like, wrecked hotel rooms and stuff, and it just turns into, like, this mess, basically. But I really loved the meteoric rise that they...
It was a really entertaining film. That was produced by Clooney, I believe.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
That makes sense. And I think at one point, if I'm remembering correctly, one of the characters drives around in the Batmobile, like the original Batmobile.
Yeah.
So, yeah, a lot of excess and all that kind of stuff, which ultimately, I think, kind of... led to the downfall of the band, but also the downfall of the movie when it goes into that kind of just like bleak and dreary territory near the end. But okay, so that's Steel Dragon. The other one, a little bit more lighthearted, The Lone Rangers. This is from the movie Airheads from 1994, starring Brendan Fraser, Steve Buscemi, and Adam Sandler. Have you guys seen this movie? Do you guys remember this?
I don't remember.
I think so. Do they kind of remember people or something?
They
in that movie?
Hold up a radio station in order to get their single played on the air.
Yeah,
it's really great. Like it's an underrated movie, I think, and it's become something of a cult classic. But it's. Man, these guys are so funny together. It's like, you know, normally I'm not the biggest Adam Sandler fan, but just the combo of him and Brendan Fraser and Steve Buscemi, it's like this mind-blowing ridiculousness of these guys, and then they hold up this record. So just the entire concept of it is really great. And then the fact that their band's name is the Lone Rangers, plural, I liked as well. So, one that P. Vader I know is a fan of, School of Rock, from the 2003 film School of Rock.
Yeah.
You want to take this one?
Yeah, I mean, it's on my list as well. I didn't really make a list, but if I did, it's on it.
You're starting to make a list. I like that part.
Yeah, I really feel that the music in this movie really helped to make it a better movie. It was one of those going in where my friend just was... You know, I guess there was nothing out at the time, so he's just like, let's see this School of Rock movie with Jack Black. And it's one of those movies that I had no expectations for. So I was really surprised by how much I liked the movie. And I think the band School of Rock had a lot to do with that.
Yeah, and those kids played their own instruments and all that. They were like real musicians and stuff. So it's pretty impressive. I think the recording of the main song... The School of Rock song was like those kids on all their playing all their instruments and stuff too. So,
yeah.
And I like the concept of the other bands and stuff. And during the Battle of the Bands, there's one part where like a guy's name is Spider, and like he's like singing along, like with playing the different chord structures and stuff. He's like A minor G O, and then, like, I don't know that movie. Yeah, I liked it a lot too when I saw it. Good stuff. Let's see, moving on, we've got, I guess keeping on the Jack Black train for the near future, a movie called High Fidelity. I'm sure most of the listeners have heard of this. You guys have seen High Fidelity, right?
Yeah.
Yeah? No. Okay. P. Vader hasn't. Got to check this one out. It's John Cusack, really great. I think Nick Hornsby wrote the book on which the movie's based. And at the very end... Jack Black's band comes and plays during this kind of signing session or something for another band, and he's introduced by John Cusack's character as Sonic Death Monkey, which is it was their name, and Jack Black like quickly corrects him and says, "Oh no, we're not Sonic Death Monkey anymore. We were going to be Kathleen Turner Overdrive," which I really enjoyed. But they kind of settled on just for that night. They're going to be Barry Jive and the Uptown Five, which I also enjoyed. So Jack Black's character breaks into this version of Marvin Gaye's "Let's Get It On," which is really awesome, and it's on YouTube and stuff. If you guys haven't seen the movie, at least watch that scene. It's pretty great, and yeah, we're talking a little bit about
that. Previous to this, Jack Black was not a known entity.
Yeah, he'd been Neverending Story 3 or something, and like very, very small roles here and there. Yeah, exactly, the Jackal.
You didn't see him as a guy who could do that. It didn't make sense. I mean, now it's like, of course. I mean, he had a characterization of himself as in a video game, pretty much.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's how embedded he is.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, it was kind of like this magic revelation, like, oh wow, dude, why is this guy in a band?
Yeah. And then he actually did form a band, Tenacious D, and they made Tenacious D in The Pick of Destiny, which is just an awful, awful movie. I really enjoyed their first album, and I was like, okay, I'll go see that movie.
I don't know why, but I stayed clear of that, and I really wanted to see it, but for some reason I never did, and
it was like Stoner Central, like not even remotely good in any capacity. Just bad news all over. I don't know. We're not going to really get into bands that are actual bands, I think.
Yeah, we're in the fictitious band.
Just the kind of fictitious thing. So Tenacious D doesn't really count for this list, but... well, actually, I don't know. There's one that's so good that I kind of have to say it, and they did kind of afterwards form a real band, and that is the Blues Brothers. They... In 1975, in Saturday Night Live, started this kind of just joking, you know, skit thing for the Blues Brothers, for Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi. And then in 1979, actually put out an album, and it did fairly well. And they were like, all right, let's make a real movie out of this. And then they did their movie thing, and then actually, like, toured the country and stuff for a little while as the Blues Brothers. So it turned into, like, a legitimate project. I feel like that might be enough for us to be able to include this on the list and differentiate it between Tenacious D, but in any case, Blues Brothers is, like, such a classic movie, and it's great for movie lovers and music lovers as well. There's a lot of really great musical sequences in this. The one I'm thinking specifically is the Shake Your Tail Feather scene with Ray Charles and that whole dance number where everybody in the town basically just breaks out into this dance. And then, I mean, you've got Aretha Franklin and stuff. I mean, there's so many great cameos, you know, Cab Calloway, all these other people. So if you guys haven't seen the Blues Brothers, yeah,
check it out.
You know what to do.
So good that they made a remake. Not a remake, they made a sequel.
Yeah, Blues Brothers 2000, which I didn't see, but I'm sure is an abomination. So one other really kind of... we've got a couple more here, but one of the really ridiculous ones is from the Goofy movie, 1995, the band being Powerline. P. Vitter remembers this.
Yeah, that's, to me, is the greatest Disney soundtrack, I think, of all time. It's definitely...
Of all time?
Yes. It's definitely... Of their animated...
I feel like you're Kanye West right now. Like, of all time!
Of their animated... features.
Sorry, you realize what
you're saying.
It's
definitely my favorite.
You realize that Disney has produced, you know, Aladdin and
I'm saying
Lion King, some of these great soundtracks.
I'm saying.
Okay. All right. Just making sure. No, I really enjoyed this too. I think the song is called Eye to Eye.
Yeah.
At the
if
very
I
end.
If I ever find that on karaoke, it's over. Like, it's done.
The perfect cast.
Yes.
One other one that we wanted to mention was the Von Trapp Family Singers. I feel like we need to include at least one older movie in this list since they're mostly modern. But for all of you cinephiles out there, The Sound of Music, 1965, that should qualify for us being able to delve back a little bit. You know, I don't know if we could really consider them a full band or a fictional band, because I think the story of Sound of Music
actually
is actually
based
on
a real
true
story.
Yeah, but... Loosely,
yeah.
So that the loosely is what qualifies it for this list, I think. One other one we want to talk about was Billy Mack from Love Actually. What is the actor's name that plays that character? It's completely escaping me.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Bill Nye. Yeah, that's right, yeah. I thought you said Bill Nye, like the science guy, and I'm like, don't think he was in Love Actually. No, you're absolutely right. I forget the name of the song that he sings in the movie. He has to rework one of his classic songs into, like, this Christmas...
No, it wasn't even a classic song, it was a...
No, one of the characters' classic songs into... He just changes the lyrics so they make sense in the context of a Christmas album, and he just doesn't take it seriously at all. And
hates it.
Yeah.
And everyone loves that he hates it, so they listen to it.
Yeah. Pretty great. And then one other really super obscure one that I want to mention that I feel like needs to be mentioned in a list like this is... Buckaroo Banzai and the Hong Kong Cavaliers. This is from a movie called Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension, which is a really, really obscure cult classic starring Peter Weller, who played RoboCop, as well as John Lithgow as, like, an alien villain, and Jeff Goldblum as, like, one of the sidekicks, like the keyboardist or something in his band.
This sounds like the most ridiculous thing ever.
Oh, man, if you've never heard of it... Guys, if you've never seen Buckaroo Banzai, like, seek it out if you can, and if you can't, just read about it on Wikipedia. It's massively entertaining. Like,
if you're listening to this podcast at work, just Google this sucker right now and then email it to yourself.
It's, like, absolutely insane. Like, Buckaroo Banzai is, like, this Renaissance man who is, like, a... rocket scientist slash musician slash like all this crazy stuff. It's like, it's out of control. So I can't even do this movie justice by talking about it in any capacity. I just have to say, for like the most insane thing, you've got to see Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension. So, and then one other that I think is probably a good one to end on for this segment is Marvin Berry and the Starlighters from Back to the Future. this is the band that plays at the Enchantment Under the Sea dance, and of course, in the kind of iconic scene where Marty is playing Johnny B. Goode, Marvin goes over to the side since he's injured his hand and calls his cousin Chuck Berry and says, "You know that new sound you've been looking for? Listen to this." So, pretty great stuff. Oh, I lied. There's one more that I want to include, and this is a super recent one, Sex Bob-omb from Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. Actually, we can include a bunch of different bands in that mix, the Clash of Demon Head and some of the others as well. Crash and the Boys, I think, was the other one. But, yeah, if you guys haven't seen Scott Pilgrim yet, I don't know why you're listening to this, because I don't consider you true fans of this show. We've recommended it multiple times, and there's nothing else we can do to sing the praises of this movie, which is definitely one of my favorite films of the year, and probably one of the most like original movies I've seen in a long, long time.
What I feel sad about Scott Pilgrim currently is the more a movie makes, the better their Blu-ray thing is, and this is probably just going to be just like...
No, I've heard they've got really great stuff lined up for the Blu-ray. Yeah, I know that they, you know, Edgar Wright, like, blogged a post a day for the entire year that he was making this movie, so a lot of that stuff is going to be on there. They've already released some footage of, like, animatics, like stick figure animations of some of the fight scenes and stuff that they created, like pre-viz stuff like that.
Yeah.
All that kind of stuff's going on there. He's going to have like four commentary tracks and things. There's going to be a ton of special features. So Scott Pilgrim is a movie where I feel like I've seen it twice in theaters, and I don't know if I could see it again in theaters just because it's a little much, to be honest, but I'm definitely getting the Blu-ray, and the bonus features are going to be a big part of the reason why, because there's going to be so much extra stuff to sift through, and that world is so much fun to go through, and they're going to have a bunch of behind-the-scenes stuff with, like, the bands and stuff, because they used real bands to sub in for the music in the movie and stuff, so there's going to be a ton of bonus features.
It's one of those films that it's a lighter film, and you can pop it in at any time. It's not like Eastern Promises, where it's like, I'm really got to be in the mode to like, I got to be, I'm, you know, I'm going to be down at some point. So
that will probably be the
only time. I'm going to cry myself to sleep or something.
The only time that anyone ever compares Scott Pilgrim and Eastern Promises in the same sentence.
Like films, comedies are easy to watch. And the fact that it's so entertaining, and like, you can jump around and it doesn't matter. Like, you could jump in halfway into this film, go, oh, that's cool, and just
still
watch
have
from there.
Half of an entertaining movie left to watch. So I love this movie. So that'll wrap it up for our discussion as far as that stuff goes. Let's talk a little bit about some of the geek news this week. One of the more interesting pieces, I thought, came from Mark Miller, who is the comic book writer, kind of creator of Wanted and Kick-Ass, and he recently... He's been gaining a bit of a reputation as kind of an egregious liar on the internet as of late. He's been, you know, talking about how he was going to write the latest X-Men movie, and that Fox is just like, no, that's not true. Like, he's just apparently making stuff up here and there. He's been, you know, at one point he was talking about a trilogy for Superman that he wanted to make and things like that, and talking about how he had all this stuff planned out when I think some of those reports may have been a bit exaggerated. He's been talking about greenlit, you know, stuff for Wanted 2, which we know that hasn't come to pass yet. So, you know, you've got to take him at for what he is at this point, which is somewhat of a hype machine for his own projects. But his new movie, or a movie that he's created, is based off of a work that he's created, is called Nemesis, and we've talked about this a couple times on the podcast.
Is it even out yet?
No, not at all. I mean, it's like... Oh, the comic? Yeah, the comic is out. I think the first couple issues are out.
Okay.
But Tony Scott recently signed on to direct this movie, and the lead characters are that Miller has in his sights to play the leads in this movie are none other than Brad Pitt and Johnny Depp, which are, like, you know, I was telling P. Vader earlier, like, yeah, any movie that has two male leads in that age range is, of course, going to want Brad Pitt and Johnny Depp, yeah. So I don't know why this is any different than anything else, but, you know, whatever. We're feeding into Mark Miller's hype machine right now by even talking about this and entertaining this as a possibility, but I like thinking about the possibilities of it. Like, yeah. Brad Pitt and Johnny Depp are two of, like, the defining actors of our generation, or the generation right above us, or whatever, this current movie-watching generation. Yeah. And thinking about them facing off as, like, in this kind of epic superhero bash in a movie that, you know, portrays a new spin on a kind of tiring superhero genre, I think could be super entertaining.
Well, I think we should talk about what that... I mean, for people who don't know or uninitiated...
Yeah, definitely.
It's a really cool... I mean, it's basically the Batman concept, but flipped.
Yeah.
So, you have this billionaire who lost his parents and is trying to get over the tragedy. The thing is, his parents were supervillains, right?
I think so.
Something like that.
He's the only supervillain in the world.
He's the only supervillain.
He takes that tragedy, and instead of fighting crime like Bruce Wayne, it's been pitched as, like, what if Batman was the Joker? So he's kind of the insane one, and he basically just goes around the world battling the best police officer in the world and making their life a living hell until they eventually die or kill themselves or whatever, and then he just moves on to the next top cop and just, like, because he's the one who has all the resources. He's a billionaire. He has the resources and the training
and no one knows who he is.
That kind of stuff. Yeah, and exactly, the kind of anonymity.
So I'm guessing Brad Pitt for the billionaire and Johnny Depp as the detective?
It's actually the other way around. Yeah, because Miller gave an interview to Empire recently, and he said, "When I was writing the comic, I genuinely saw Johnny Depp as Nemesis. He's a thin-faced guy, slightly creepy, a cross between Heath Ledger and Christian Bale, and someone who could pull off both of those things at the same time is Johnny Depp. He would get it. He goes slightly crazy in his roles."
I can actually see that now that he's talking about it. Because I was thinking, like, that would be kind of a stretch. I mean, other than seeing Brad Pitt in 12 Monkeys, I haven't seen him not be like Brad Pitt.
True Romance, I think, is a good example. He had a super small cameo in that, basically. But,
yeah.
He
doesn't really diverge and open up his acting repertoire. I mean, Johnny Depp, I mean, this guy's taken on caricatures.
Yeah. He's done a bunch of stuff. But yeah, Miller, you know, talking a little bit about Brad Pitt, he says he wants Brad Pitt for the role of Blake Morrow, which is the police detective protagonist. He says, "He's Commissioner Gordon meets Sherlock Holmes, so it's got to be a big physical policeman who you could feel could stand up for himself in a physical fight. It's got to be somebody who can take a punch. You couldn't really get anybody who's too cerebral. He'd have to be a very physical actor, so it would need to be a Brad Pitt or maybe even a Liam Neeson." So that's an interesting concept as well, especially Depp versus Leeson, or versus Neeson, which is like takes it to a whole nother level, especially with Liam Neeson's recent filmography, you know, Taken being the big kind of action stamp that he's had in the past couple of years. But yeah, I don't know. What do you guys think about Depp versus Pitt in an on-screen battle? Like,
I'd say good luck. I mean, I don't know if
Nemesis, I don't think it's gonna happen.
Yeah, I don't know if it's gonna have the kind of budget to pull
those. I think he said he wants
in.
It to be like $140 million for the budget or
well,
something.
Yeah, I mean, there's
Tony Scott get $140 million for a film?
I don't know, man. His films look expensive because he always flips cars and blows crap up. So I don't know. I'm not sure.
$100 million, $110 million maybe, but $140 million. I mean, I guess
that's getting up there.
Yeah, that's a lot.
He's been very bold in, like, his statements in describing his character as a combination of Heath Ledger and Christian Bale.
I think he was saying,
like, as good as those guys were in that movie, this character is so good that it's the combination of both. Or is that what he's...
I don't know. Or
could it be so bad he has a combination
of both? I think he's saying that, yeah. I think that's what he's implying,
yeah.
You know, subliminally or not. But, I don't know if he was saying Depp as this character would be that, or his character.
That's how
was
I
like
it.
That.
Is this
so, yeah.
Scott's next film?
Or something? There's, It's unclear. He's been balancing a bunch of other projects.
Is he, the Warriors? Is that still happening?
I hope it does. To be honest with you,
I like. What was it like? They got a like a, an agreement between all the actual gangs in LA that they will shoot an actual film together and not kill each other and be in the same space. And it'd be like, holy cow, that is the coolest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah. And they want, like, they want all the real gangs to be extras and all that kind of stuff in the movie. It's going to be insane. Because they're transplanting it from New York to Los Angeles for the remake. But I don't know. I hope that still happens. I don't think there's been any movement on it in the past, you know, 6 months or something like that.
It's probably because of all the crazy taxes California's currently doing.
Yeah. Yeah. but I'm with you guys. I would love to see this. I just don't think it's very... legit. Plausible. Yeah, plausible. Yeah, thank you.
It's weird how Vancouver looks so much like LA. Oh, wait, no.
So let's move on and talk a little bit about the potential of Darren Aronofsky to direct Wolverine 2. This is just like a total WTF for me. Like, how does Darren Aronofsky figure into the Wolverine timeline here? I don't understand.
He just came off of RoboCop. Right?
Or, just dropped the project or whatever. I don't know what happened with that, but apparently he's no longer... Well, I guess it's an MGM project, so that's probably
anything
why.
Anything with MGM attached is pretty much dead.
Yeah. I don't know. There was apparently David Slade, who did 30 Days of Night and Twilight Eclipse, and Robert Schwenke, who did Flight Plan, and I think he directed the upcoming Red movie with Bruce Willis and Helen Mirren. Were supposed to be up for the job of it, but Slade was supposedly the favorite between those two choices, and now Deadline's reporting that Darren Aronofsky is added to that mix, and it's like, that does not seem like something that would fit well with Darren Aronofsky's filmography. You've got Pi, Requiem for a Dream, I'm probably missing something in there, Fountain, and the Wrestler, obviously, Black Swan, which is the new Natalie Portman, Mila Kunis one coming out, and then Wolverine 2? Like, what? One of these things is not like the other.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think maybe they're just trying to...
If they get him, it'll be an awesome Wolverine film.
Yeah.
If they get him.
Well, the thing is, he's got... Aronofsky has a good working relationship with Hugh Jackman, because... he worked with him in The Fountain. Yeah, Brad Pitt was actually supposed to play the lead. It was supposed to be Brad Pitt and Cate Blanchett for The Fountain, and then they ended up dropping out because the scheduling wasn't working. So
they ended up doing Benjamin Button.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and then Hugh Jackman and Rachel Weisz stepped in for The Fountain, and that project was like years in the making because of all these scheduling conflicts and all the work that it took to like track down these kind of ancient Mayan looking locations and all the craziness that they had to do for that. But I'm sure they formed a pretty good working relationship on that movie. And it sounds like that would be the only, meager connection that you could draw.
Especially if it's the story that Jackman is saying. It's Wolverine in Japan.
Right.
I mean, that would be awesome.
Yeah. Venkman, in his post, wrote up that the story is based on the classic Frank Miller comic where Wolverine goes to Japan to find Mariko and gets involved with a battle in the Japanese underworld. So, yeah, I mean, I can't even imagine, though, what an Aronofsky-directed Wolverine movie would look like. I don't even...
With Wolverine against Samurai.
I can't fathom that. Like, I don't think Aronofsky's ever... I know for a fact he's never done anything remotely approaching a studio superhero movie like this. Like... RoboCop, I can see, that there's potential there for the commentaries on the nature of man versus technology and then the kind of combination of the two and this very kind of intellectual material that
I
feel
like...
Yeah, I forgot,
when is that time period, actually, that that comic book is...
I don't recall.
Is it after the metal or before the metal?
I think it's post... Adamantium.
Okay, then it's really different. Yeah.
I could be wrong about that. It's been I read one of those comics a long time ago, but it's been many years. But yeah, I guess that does kind of matter in the overall scheme of things as to whether or not this turns into like a glorified period piece or whether it's something set in the kind of modern day.
Yeah.
But with samurais and stuff, I feel like they're going back a little ways. Like it's not going to be the triads and the kind of Rush Hour 2 Japanese underworld. It'll be something a little bit more traditional, I feel
Rush
like.
Rush Hour 2 is in China.
Excuse me. Yeah, sorry. That's racist on my part. Thanks for calling me out on that. So
no worries.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, again.
I think maybe they just need to do something to try and reinvigorate. Is that a word? That's a word.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
The life back into this Wolverine, who has kind of been staggering through, after let's say the second X-Men movie,
sure.
X-Men movie, to the third, which was not very good.
Yep.
To, the first Wolverine by himself movie, which I actually didn't see, so I can't really commentate.
It's bad.
But yeah, apparently it's bad. So I think they're just trying to like, not do a 180, but you know. Give it something to where audiences are going to be interested in seeing something new.
I don't understand, because didn't Hugh Jackman, when they were talking about the original concept of an X-Men Origins Wolverine movie, didn't he back then say, hey, let's do this Japanese storyline, because that's the story that everybody loves, and I think this would make a great movie?
That's the one that people wanted.
I think that's what Hugh Jackman himself was championing at the time, and that apparently didn't come through, because it seems to me that Fox just stepped in and was like, no, we need every mutant who didn't appear in the X-Men movies to make an appearance here, and by the way, let's completely butcher Deadpool in every form, and then try to go ahead and give him his own spin-off movie after that. It's just, like, Fox has not been making very good decisions when it comes to the X-Men franchise recently. Hopefully, Matthew Vaughn's X-Men First Class will kind of do its part to reverse that. But I feel like there's only so many X-Men stories you can tell on camera, and the Wolverine Japan one is definitely one of them. It's a very cinematic story, and I think with the right director, it could turn into a good movie, which is something that...
Yeah, and there also comes a point where Hugh Jackman can only look
good. Yeah, he's got a window there.
Yeah. You go, oh, wow, he does look really a lot older than he should.
Yeah, and he's probably going to lose interest in the character after a while, too. I mean,
it takes a lot to physically do all that stuff
in
a film.
You know, he's played Wolverine for 4 films now. He's reaching what Harrison Ford did in Indiana Jones over the course of however many years, 30 years or something, you know, and he's done it in 10. So, I imagine as an actor, he probably wants to stretch his legs a little bit and do some different projects and stuff, which, you know, The Fountain being one of them that he did in between there, which is a really great movie, by the way. If you guys haven't seen The Fountain, highly recommend it. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think we've pretty much exhausted this topic. Am I right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, last one, we want to talk a little bit about this movie. There's not much. We don't know what it's called. We don't know really what it's about, but Bradley Cooper and Ryan Reynolds are attached to star in this new kind of buddy cop action comedy, and the story, what little we know of it, follows two friends who are cops in San Francisco whose fathers were once partners on the police force, and the older generation is kind of forced out of retirement to help them, to help their sons crack a case, which... Okay, that concept sounds kind of terrible. I'm not going to lie. Like, that sounds like a
film. I was on board until you said the fathers come out of retirement.
Yeah, yeah, that's the aspect that completely throws it off. But
who were their fathers?
If Mel Gibson was not a raving lunatic, that I guarantee they would try to get Mel Gibson and Danny Glover to do this. To be like a spiritual sequel to Lethal Weapon.
Or Clint Eastwood. And
yeah, yeah, that actually is better based on the Dirty Harry movies actually taking place in San Francisco, or most of them anyway. But yeah, the movie is actually written by Sheldon Turner, who is one of the writers for Up in the Air, the Jason Reitman, George Clooney movie from last year. And the concept of Bradley Cooper and Ryan Reynolds together seems intriguing to me. What do you guys think about that?
Yeah, it's an interesting combo. I really like Bradley Cooper. And, you know, Ryan Reynolds is cool enough. I think after the next couple of years, seeing all the new different projects you're going to see Ryan Reynolds in, it'll be interesting to see this combo together. Yeah, dang it. I wish I hadn't heard the father's thing. That just kind of like throws everything off.
It really sucks the enjoyment out of this project for me before it even gets started. Because I feel like they had a good opportunity.
It feels like two guys too many.
Yeah.
Or you're going to have the fathers be completely irrelevant characters, and it's like, why are they part of this story?
The buddy cop formula is just something that's so played out, and I feel like you have to do, you have to either do something different with it, like the other guys did, or just completely start from scratch and try to, you know, make it cool again, as opposed to, being, like, ironic with it or whatever. And I think the concept of the dads coming in and helping out is just, like, a lowest common denominator thing where they can get Betty White to co-star as the wife of one of the you know, like, it's gonna be something that's just gonna be, like, I feel like this could be, like, Old Dogs bad, or, like, Wild Hogs bad, based on the idea of
or
that.
Or it could be Space Cowboys good.
It's possible, but only if they get, like, Robert Duvall as one of the dads. If you, it depends on
Who the dads are. It's gotta be, like, and the dads, you know? It's gotta, like, be great. It's gotta be, like, Clint Eastwood, Robert Duvall.
That would be really awesome, actually.
Harrison Ford.
Yeah. You know, we're writing it off right now based on the concept that they're going to get somebody terrible to play the dads, and it's going to be goofy. But if they, maybe, if they take a serious turn with it and not make it, like, goofy and jokey and stupid, then maybe it has some potential. I don't know. Just that concept does not inspire a lot of confidence in me in its current form. So we'll reserve more judgment for further developments with it. But
it's a comedy.
Yeah, you know, you can only do so much with it. Yeah, actually, the quote here that Venkman wrote up in this post says that Hollywood Reporter reports that the action is meant to have an updated Lethal Weapon flavor that plays into edgier R-rated territory. So, I don't know. You've got the two, like, most shirtless, abbiest guys in Hollywood with Bradley Cooper and Ryan Reynolds in there. I mean, you throw Taylor Lautner in as a rookie cop, and I think you got yourself, like, the most abtastic movie ever made besides 300. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe
I feel like the Lethal Weapon formula has, like, been retired. Like, I thought that's why Kiss Kiss Bang Bang was such a brilliant film, because it was such a I don't.
That movie is just in a category all of its own. I think it. Nobody really gives that movie the respect that it deserves, and I wish it would have made a bigger impact on the rest of the genre, like it should have. And it's just kind of, it's been a blip that people, like, oh yeah, that's a really great movie, but it hasn't really impacted anything, unfortunately. I don't know, maybe Shane Black, because Shane Black was responsible for Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. He wrote and directed that movie, and actually wrote the original Lethal Weapon movie, and created all that stuff. So he, that's why that movie was so great, is because he had such a personal connection with that genre. I would say Lethal Weapon kind of, if not started that really kind of 80s buddy cop genre, at least made it the most popular. I mean, there's been other movies like 48 Hours and those other kinds of team up stuff
made
around
worth
that same time. Yeah, but Lethal Weapon was definitely, like, the most iconic, I think. So yeah, Shane Black, maybe Shane Black could come out of nowhere and direct this or something, and kind of do a rewrite or something, or team up with Sheldon Cooper. I don't know. We're getting into, like, fantasy.
Fantasy filmmaking. Yeah.
We're getting into Mark Miller categories.
Yeah, we are.
Armchair producing.
That's a dangerous place to be, so we'll move on out of that. Let's talk about what's coming up next week. Machete, or Machete, as the trailers seem to insist on themselves.
Such, like, over-pronunciation.
Yeah. The movie starring Danny Trejo and, surprisingly, a ridiculous cast of, you know, Robert De Niro, Jessica Alba, Lindsay Lohan, Jeff Fahey, who played Frank Lapidus in Lost, just a crap ton, Steven Seagal.
A weird,
ridiculous cast. So I don't know how this movie is going to turn out. It's based on a trailer that was in the Grindhouse movies. So Robert Rodriguez co-directed it, and we'll see how it goes. I mean, I kind of want to see it, but I feel like it's going to be, I don't know. What do you guys think? What are your thoughts going into Machete? What do you think?
It kind of snuck up on me, because I didn't really know a whole lot about it. Obviously, I knew it was in the, it was a trailer in the Grindhouse movie. But, yeah, I think I'd be interested in it. It's got one of those ensemble casts. Those seem to be popular this summer.
Yeah.
With, like, A-Team, Scott Pilgrim, The Expendables.
Inception,
yeah.
Red.
Yeah.
So, yeah, in the theme of this summer, I'm willing to give it a shot, even though the summer's almost over.
All right, good stuff. And then also, Going the Distance. This is the Drew Barrymore and Justin Long romantic comedy. I actually saw this movie last night at an early screening, and it was all right. I'll talk about it a little bit more next week, maybe, if there's not much to talk about.
It probably
about.
Doesn't over or under deliver in any way.
Completely middle of the road. So that's my mini review right there. If you like the trailer, you'll probably like it. It's just kind of exactly what you think it's going to be. No big surprises. I was hoping that it would surprise me, and it didn't. So, you know, whatever. Nothing crazy. It's not the worst romantic comedy I've seen by a long shot. It's way better than anything Katherine Heigl's done in the past few years.
Oh, my goodness. Or Jennifer Aniston.
Yep. Way better than anything she's done as well. So,
the Switch came out, right? Didn't that?
It did, and apparently did not do very well at all.
Didn't even blip the top five.
Yeah, so maybe we'll talk about some of that stuff. Maybe somebody will get a chance to see Machete. If not one of us, then possibly Venkman.
Venkman's going to watch Machete.
He's going to love it.
If he doesn't, I would be surprised.
Yeah, so that's stick around and join us next week for our discussion on probably both of those films. Feel free to subscribe to us on iTunes. It's free. You should do it. It's really easy. You can also fan us, or actually I believe the terminology now is like us, on Facebook at facebook.com/geektyrantfans. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/geektyrant. And feel free to check out our store, which is at geektyrant.me. You can check out the t-shirts and stuff we've got up there, as well as sunglasses and a bunch of other cool stuff. And also, if you guys like what you hear, like what you read at the site, you can donate at geektyrant.com/donate. Your donations help keep the podcast running, keep the site going. We would really appreciate anything you guys could throw our way as far as that stuff goes. So, thanks for listening, guys. Thanks for joining us here on the panel as well. Thank you, guys. And we will see you guys next week.